Hello everyone and welcome to Raya Affairs for a new episode. My name is Nicola and as always I'll be your host. Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind the scenes of decision makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, we start with the disclaimer that expressed opinion in these episodes are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Raya, as we specialize in unbiased writing. So in today's episode, we will be talking about one of the most complex and devastating conflicts on the African continent, the ongoing crisis in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. We will discuss ongoing hostilities between Sultani Makenga, leader of the M23 rebel group, and Felix Tshisekedi, president of the DRC. And joining me today is Lily Sage, who recently wrote an article on the topic. So hello, Lily, and welcome back to Raya Affairs. It's a pleasure to have you here. And thank you very much for joining me today. I know you've already been on the podcast with us, but I will still ask you to introduce yourself to our audience, please.
Hi, Nicola. Thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Lily Sage Bays, and I'm in the research and analysis team at Raya. And I'm from Botswana, going into my third year of studying international relations at IE University.
Well, thank you very much for introducing yourself again, Lily. And as you know, before we start to talk about today's topic, I'll ask you to answer again our usual icebreaking question. This time you get to choose a different leader. So could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world, would you want to have a conversation with and why?
So this time I'd have to choose Seretse Khama. He was Botswana's first president, serving from 1966 until his death in 1980. His impact on Botswana is immense because he transformed one of the poorest nations at independence into a beacon of democracy, stability, and rapid economic growth. Botswana has achieved one of the highest growing economies globally between 1960 and 1980, largely due to his prudent management of diamond revenues and establishment of robust democratic institutions. This successful post-independence nation building experience offers a valuable comparative lens, which we'll see today, when examining the Democratic Republic of Congo's own complex history since independence. The DRC has faced significant challenges in establishing stable governance and effectively leveraging its vast natural resources for widespread development against a backdrop of persistent internal and regional conflicts.
Well, that's very, very interesting. Thank you very much, Lily. It's always a pleasure to have you here and mention all these African leaders that are not often mentioned. So it's really great to have this perspective here. And now I would say that we can start our conversation about your article. And I'd like to start with just a brief overview of the topic. So your article outlines a dramatic resurgence in violence in the Eastern DRC. So for our listeners who might not be up to speed, can you briefly explain who Sultani Makenga is, what the M23 is, and why they've returned to the spotlight in 2025?
Yes, absolutely. So Sultani Makenga is a key figure in the ongoing conflict in DRC. He's a Congolese leader and military chief of the M23 or March 23 movement. He's an ethnic Tutsi and has a long history in various Congolese conflicts, dating back to the Rwandan Civil War and the First and Second Congo Wars. He was born in the North Kivu province in 1973. The M23 was originally formed in 2012 by Congolese Tutsi defectors from the Congolese army, the FARDC. They claimed the government had failed to honor a 2009 peace deal that was meant to integrate former combatants, primarily from a previous Tutsi-led group called the CNDP, into the National Army. So although military defeated in 2013, the M23 re-emerged in late 2012, stating that Kinshasa had not upheld the 2013 Nairobi Declaration and continued to neglect Tutsi security. 2025 has been quite dramatic. In January 2025, the M23 launched significant offenses, seizing strategic towns and resource-rich areas in the North Kivu province, including vital mining zones. This rapid advance, including the capture of Goma and subsequent pushes towards Bukavu, has been described as the largest escalation in the Kivu conflict since M23 occupied Goma in 2012. So this resurgence is fueled by unresolved political, ethnic, and economic grievances, coupled with the ongoing weaknesses of the Congolese state.
So you mentioned that the M23 movement mainly seeks political recognition and territorial control, as you said, especially of mineral-rich areas of the country, and it's mainly utilizing state weakness and Tutsi marginalization. However, as you point out in your article, the ongoing hostilities are also linked to the failure of previous peace efforts. So you already mentioned a couple of declarations, but could you walk us through the diplomatic history of this conflict? Because since the emergence of the M23 movement, there have been many attempts to reach a peace agreement, but they've all failed. So why all these attempts failed?
So the diplomatic history is indeed complex and riddled with failures. The M23 itself is a product of a failed peace deal. The 2009 Amani-Leo Agreement, which aimed to integrate former CNDP combatants. When the government was perceived to have failed to uphold this, the M23 formed in 2012. Following their military defeat in 2013, like I previously stated, there was the Nairobi Declaration, which again wasn't fully implemented. So these failures stem from a combination of factors. Firstly, there's been a persistent issue of flawed enforcement of agreements. Even when deals are signed, the political will or capacity to see them through to completion often falls short. Secondly, there's been a problem of exclusionary negotiations. Often stakeholders, particularly the M23 themselves, feel their grievances or demands for political recognition are not adequately addressed, or they're excluded from the negotiation table, leading them to feel these agreements don't fully represent their interests. A crucial example of this is the recent US brokered deal in Washington, where the M23 representatives were notably absent. Thirdly, the neglect of root causes plays a significant role. The conflict isn't just about armed groups, it's deeply rooted in issues like land disputes, ethnic tensions, especially the marginalization of the Tutsi community, which the M23 claims to represent. The pervasive competition over mineral resources, if these underlying issues aren't then systematically addressed, any peace agreement is built on shaky ground. And finally, the ambiguity of the M23's character has also complicated diplomatic efforts. Some view them as legitimate actors with grievances open to negotiation, while others see them as purely a proxy for Rwandan interests, requiring a military solution. These differing interpretations has led to contradictory approaches from various international and regional actors.
Well, thank you very much. This really seems like a super complex topic, and it's really useful to hear this brief overview of the diplomatic history of the conflict and some of the reasons why it has been really difficult to find a solution. But now I would like to shift the focus to President Tshisekedi, so the president of the DRC. And I would like to know from you, how has his strategy evolved in dealing with the M23? Because From what you wrote in your article, his government has rejected negotiations and opted instead for military solutions. So what is driving this hardline approach, and is it working?
So President Tshisekedi has indeed seen an evolution. Initially, his government adopted the hardline stance, largely rejecting direct negotiations, which you said, of the M23 and prioritizing military solutions. This approach is primarily driven by a desire to restore state authority and stability in Eastern DRC and to legitimize the M23 by insisting on their disarmament as a precondition for any talks. He also frames Rwanda's alleged support for M23 as an existential threat to Congolese sovereignty, using this narrative to rally national support. So his hardline stance often serves domestic political purposes. It allows President Tshisekedi to project strength and counter criticism about the ongoing insecurity, bolstering his own political legitimacy. However, in terms of effectiveness, this hardline approach has proven problematic. It has repeatedly stalled peace efforts as the M23 continues to demand political recognition. So militarily, despite some counter-offensives by the FARDC, the regional support, the M23 has continued to gain ground. And as of March 2025, the M23 still controls these key urban centers. So the FARDC continues to face these structural issues, including poor coordination, entrenched corruption, and low morale, limiting its capacity to decisively defeat the M23. The quick success of the M23's operation to cut off Goma in January indicated FARDC's morale and defenses were breaking. So more recently, there has been a slight shift in President Tshisekedi's approach, indicating a recognition of the mounting military pressures and diminishing regional support for a purely military solution. So this does signal pragmatic and willingness to engage in dialogue, but for the underlying insistence on disarmament, it does remain a hurdle.
And as you mentioned, a key dimension in all this story is Rwanda's alleged involvement and support for the M23. So I wanted to ask you, how has this affected the evolution of the conflict and especially the relations between Kinshasa and Kigali?
So Rwanda's alleged involvement is undeniably a critical and highly conscientious dimension of the conflict, profoundly affecting its evolution and severely straining relations between Kinshasa and Kigali, which you said. So numerous reports, including from the UN group of experts, suggest that Rwanda provides significant military and logistical support to the M23. So this support is believed to be a decisive factor in M23's continued military success and its ability to hold all the territory that they do have. So from Kinshasa's perspective, this alleged support is seen as a direct violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. President Tshisekedi has consistently accused Rwanda of aggression and using M23 as a proxy to exploit the DRC's vast mineral wealth and destabilize the eastern region. So this narrative has been central, as I said, to his efforts to mobilize national and international support against the M23. But from Kigali's side, Rwanda denies this direct involvement and often justifies its actions or alleged actions by citing security concerns, particularly the presence of the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, FDLR, in eastern DRC. So the FDLR is an ethnic Hutu militia, some of whose leaders participated in the 1994 Rwandan genocide. So Rwanda argues that the DRC government has not effectively dealt with this threat, and therefore it has legitimate security interests in the region. However, critics argue that the FDLR no longer poses a substantial threat to Rwanda and that Kigali's real motivations are economic, particularly access to critical minerals. So this dynamic has created profound rift in diplomatic relations. While there have been mediation efforts by regional and international actors, the underlying mistrust and accusations continue to fuel these hostilities. So the relationship is characterized by frequent diplomatic disputes, border closures, and heightened military activity, creating a very volatile regional environment.
And as you said before, the foreign ministers of Rwanda and the DRC recently signed a U.S. brokered peace deal in Washington on June 27th. The agreement includes a phased withdrawal of Rwandan troops within 90 days, a ban on DRC support for Hutu militias like the FDLR that you mentioned previously, and the establishment of a joint security mechanism and a regional economic integration framework backed by U.S. investment in critical minerals. So do you think that this agreement will facilitate a solution to the conflict on the ground, or it's going to be yet another failure, especially considering that, as you said before, no representatives of the M23 were present in Washington?
So this U.S. brokered peace deal is certainly a significant diplomatic development, particularly with the involvement of a major international actor like the U.S. and its focus on critical minerals. The provisions, as you stated, phased withdrawal of Rwandan troops, a ban on DRC support for Hutu militias like the FDLR, joint security mechanisms, and regional economic framework are all crucial elements that, if implemented, could lay the groundwork for peace. However, whether it will facilitate a genuine solution on the ground or become yet another failure is a critical question. I lean towards the caution and would argue that it faces significant hurdles. The most immediate challenge, as you rightly point out, is the absence of M23 representatives at the signing of Washington. So the M23 being a primary armed actor, actively controlling territory and engaged in these hostilities. So any peace that does not directly involve them and address their stated grievances and demands for political recognition risks being seen as illegitimate or incomplete by the group itself. The exclusion could lead to them continue fighting, rendering the agreement ineffective on the battlefield. While the agreement addresses key issues like troop withdrawal and support for militias, the devil is in the details of implementation. Previous agreements have failed due to flawed enforcement. Will there be a robust independent monitoring mechanisms to verify the withdrawal of the Rwandan troops and ending of support of these militias. The success of joint security mechanisms will also depend heavily on the level of trust and cooperation between Kinshasa and Kigali, which has been historically very low. So the regional economic integration framework backed by the US investment in critical minerals is an interesting addition, aiming to address the economic drivers of the conflict. However, for this to genuinely contribute to peace, it needs equitable benefits for local communities and prevent illicit exploitation that often funds these armed groups. Ultimately, with this agreement marks a step forward in high-level diplomacy between DRC and Rwanda. Its impact on the ground will depend on whether it can effectively be translated into concrete actions that brings all armed groups, including the M23, to a verifiable and sustained ending of hostilities, and ultimately to a comprehensive political solution that addresses the conflict's root causes. So without the buy-in and active participation of the M23, it does risk remaining a top-down agreement that doesn't fully resolve on the conflict's realities.
So your article notes that hundreds of thousands have been displaced in this conflict, especially in areas like Goma and Bukavu. What does the humanitarian picture look like on the ground today, and how are international organizations responding? Are they able to effectively operate given the scale of displacement and ongoing violence?
The humanitarian picture in Eastern DRC, particularly the North and the South Kivu, is absolutely dire and frankly catastrophic. The scale of the displacement is staggering, with over 7 million people displaced across the DRC. So recent intensified fighting has led to, as you said, hundreds of thousands of new displacements, with a significant number being women and young children. Basic services are collapsing, and there are widespread reports of severe human rights violations. The recent M23 offensive, particularly the capture of Goma, has led to a rapid deterioration. Reports include widespread looting, especially of medical supplies, food, and water. Essential services have been severely impacted, with power outages, water shortages, and communication blackouts. Roads are cut off, ports are closed, and internet access is limited, making humanitarian access incredibly difficult. People are fleeing to overcrowded IDP camps, host families, churches, and schools, often with nothing but clothes on their backs. Immediate needs are immense. Clean water, with many resorting to fetching from Lake Kivu, raising cholera concerns. Food insecurity is also rampant. Health services are stretched beyond its limits, with hospitals overwhelmed and supplies running low. And the psychosocial support is urgently needed for those traumatized by the violence. International organizations are indeed responding, but they are severely challenged by the scale of the crisis and the ongoing violence. They face significant operation hurdles due to security threats, logistical barriers, and the large number of people in need. So while organizations like UNICEF are working to provide essential supplies, food, and water, the magnitude of the crisis often overwhelms their capacity. Access to affected areas is frequently impeded by active conflict zones, preventing aid from reaching those most in need. So despite their efforts, the humanitarian response remains insufficient given the immense and escalating needs on the ground.
Well, yes, the situation is truly catastrophic, and the humanitarian picture right now, it's a complete catastrophe. So my next question is, again, about diplomacy. So despite multiple peace efforts, from the Luanda process led by Angola to the ceasefire agreement signed in April in Doha, violence continues, and the ceasefire remains highly fragile and frequently violated, even as negotiations between the DRC government and the M23 are still ongoing in Qatar. Why have all these diplomatic efforts failed? Do you think Tshisekedi is genuinely invested in diplomacy, or are these more performative gestures?
The persistent failure of these diplomatic efforts, like the Luanda process and the Doha ceasefire, can be attributed to several critical factors that often plague these complex conflicts. So firstly, a lack of genuine political will and trust among parties is a major impediment. While agreements are signed, the underlying mistrust between Kinshasa, Kigali, and the M23 runs very deep. Each party often views these negotiations as opportunities to gain strategic advantage rather than genuinely committing to a compromise for lasting peace. Secondly, the exclusion of the key actors, like we said, the M23, as the primary armed group controlling this significant territory, isn't fully integrated and doesn't see their core grievances addressed. So they have little incentive to adhere to these terms. Thirdly, the failure to address the root causes continues to be a problem. As mentioned, issues like land, citizenship, marginalization, and control over mineral resources are fundamental. Until these are systematically and inclusively addressed, any ceasefire or peace deal will remain a superficial solution. So regarding President Tshisekedi's investment in diplomacy, it's a nuanced picture. The mounting military pressure on the FARDC and the overwhelming humanitarian crisis have arguably forced his hand. His agreement to attend the Doha talks indicated a pragmatic shift towards engagement. However, his continued insistence on M23's disarmament as a precondition for meaningful political dialogue suggests his diplomatic overtures are sometimes performative gestures. These actions aim to demonstrate his governmental engagement while still holding firm on his positions that hinder a breakthrough. He is under immense domestic pressure to appear strong and protect Congolese sovereignty, but the reality is that for diplomacy to succeed, all parties need to show flexibility and a genuine commitment to compromise, which has been largely absent so far.
And given the scale of the conflict, what have been the reactions from regional bodies like the East African Community or the African Union, but also international actors, including the UN and Western governments?
Regional bodies like the East African Community, EAC, and the African Union, AU, have certainly been active, but their effectiveness has been mixed. The EAC and the AU have consistently called for dialogue and ending these hostilities, participating in various mediation processes like the Luanda process. However, they have often lacked these strong enforcement mechanisms or the unified political will to compel belligerents to adhere to their agreements. From international actors, the responses vary. The United Nations has been deeply involved, primarily through its peacekeeping mission, MONUSCO. MONUSCO has been present in the DRC for decades with a mandate to protect the civilians. They have condemned the violence, documented human rights abuses, and provided some support to the FARDC. However, MONUSCO itself has faced criticism for its perceived ineffectiveness and has been gradually drawing its forces with a full withdrawal in the end of 2024. So human rights experts have also called for urgent measures to address these grave violations, particularly against children. And then looking at Western governments, including the US and the European Union, they have expressed strong condemnation of the violence and called for diplomatic solutions. They provided humanitarian aid, although it's often insufficient given the scale of the crisis. The US in particular, as we have seen, has ramped up its diplomatic engagement, shown in the recent US brokered peace deal with DRC and Rwanda. They have also pledged technical and financial support for FARDC reforms. And then there's also another side of sanctions, which have been imposed on certain individuals and entities involved in the conflict, including Sultani Makenga himself by the UN Security Council in November 2012 and subsequently the United States. However, these actions so far have failed to meaningfully deter M23 advances or significantly alter the dynamics on the ground. The focus from these international actors is largely promoting dialogue and protecting civilians, but the systemic challenges and deep-seated nature of the conflict often limit their direct impact.
In your article, you mentioned Uganda as another important regional player who could have an impact on the current situation. So could you please expand on this and explain what could be the role of Uganda in all this?
Yes. So Ugandan's role in Eastern DRC conflict is indeed complex, making it an important, if sometimes ambiguous, regional player. On the one hand, Uganda maintains a security partnership with the DRC government. They have conducted joint military operations since 2012, primarily targeting Islamist insurgents like the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, which is originally a Ugandan group now affiliated with ISIS. This cooperation has seen the Ugandan People's Defense Force operating deep inside Congolese territory, taking control of territory in June 2025. So this allows Uganda to create the buffer zone on its border and limit cross-border attacks into its territory. However, Uganda also pursues its own strategic and economic interests, which can sometimes complicate peace efforts. These interests include influence over Congolese resources such as gold, timber, and regional competition with Rwanda. The UN has repeatedly reported on the close relationship between M23 and Uganda, with allegations that Uganda has allowed M23 to use its territory for various purposes since the group's resurgence. So this dual role, where Uganda is simultaneously cooperating with the DRC government against some armed groups, while allegedly maintaining ties to others, adds an additional layer of complexity to the conflict. So it increases the number of armed actors on the ground and injects regional rivalries deeper into local conflicts, making a comprehensive and lasting peace more elusive. Uganda's actions are often seen as hedging its bets and strengthening its sphere of influence in Eastern DRC, which can inadvertently perpetuate instability.
Well, now I would like to touch upon the theme of natural resources in the DRC. We've already spoken about it really briefly, but I would like to ask you in general, how do natural resources factor into the conflict, especially considering that the M23 controls most of the mineral-rich areas of the country?
Natural resources are a central and deeply entrenched factor driving the conflict in Eastern DRC. The region is incredibly rich in valuable minerals, including coltan used for electronics, gold and copper. So M23's strategic objective, as you noted, is not just political recognition, but territorial control, specifically of these mineral-rich areas. So by controlling these areas, armed groups like M23 can finance their operations through illicit trade. They often levy illegal taxes on mining activities, engage in direct extraction, and participate in the smuggling networks that transport these minerals across borders, often into neighboring countries like Rwanda and Uganda, where they can enter the global supply chains. For example, the UN suggested that between April and December 2024, the group M23 made $800 million in revenue related to coltan mining alone. This illicit revenue stream provides the M23 with financial means to purchase weapons, pay fighters, and sustain their insurgency, essentially making them self-sufficient and less reliant on state or external funding that might be subject to international pressure. This resource wealth often fuels regional competition. Neighboring countries often accuse of supporting various armed groups, including the M23, to secure these access to the minerals. This economic incentive creates a difficult dynamic where stability is undermined because instability allows for unregulated and highly profitable exploitation. The proposed US brokered deal, focusing on US investment in critical minerals with the regional economic framework, attempts to address this by aiming for greater transparency and legal pathways for resource extraction, hoping to block this illicit economic channels that they have. However, the deep-seated nature of these illicit networks makes this a formidable challenge. The struggle for control over these lucrative resources essentially perpetuates a cycle of violence as armed groups vie for dominance over extraction sites and smuggling routes.
And finally, could you please give us an overview of the situation on the ground right now? What have been the most recent developments? And looking ahead, what do you think will take to reach a sustainable resolution to the conflict?
Eastern DRC remains a crucible of conflicts, a human tragedy unfolding with terrifying speed. The M23 still holds significant territory, and UN reports continue to accuse Rwanda of commanding and supplying them. Claims Rwanda denies, even though as the Congolese government reportedly backs its own militias. So diplomatically, the US brokered peace deal between the DRC and Rwanda sought to de-escalate these tensions, but is it really a turning point or a pointless turn? Rwanda's President Kagame cautions welcome rings with uncertainty as he warns of retaliation if Kinshasa falters. Crucially, as states the M23, a primary armed actor, publicly states that this deal does not concern them, undermining its immediate impact on the ground. As separate direct talks loom in Doha, a troubling undercurrent persists, the fear that external interest in critical minerals could lead to a peaceful exploitation, leaving true peace and justice for the Congolese people elusive. Looking at a pathway to a sustainable resolution, the DRC necessitates a comprehensive and genuinely inclusive approach that transcends military solutions and addresses the conflict's deep-seated drivers. So firstly, inclusive political dialogue must be prioritized, bringing all major armed groups, crucially the M23, into direct good faith negotiations to address their core political grievances and demand for recognition. This isn't merely about talk, but about committed engagement to bridge this deep distrust that has plagued previous efforts. Secondly, an effort to resolve underlying root causes is essential. This includes securing land tenure, ensuring citizenship rights for marginalized communities, and establishing transparent and equitable management of the DRC's vast mineral wealth. Such reform demands significant commitment to good governance within the DRC, transforming resources from a curse into a catalyst for development. Thirdly, robust security sector reform of the FARDC is critical, fostering a professional, accountable national army capable of securing the population and asserting state authority, thereby diminishing reliance on and proliferation of these armed groups. Fourthly, a verifiable and independently monitored ceasefire must be implemented, followed by a robust demilitarization processes for all these armed groups. So this requires a clear and sustainable pathway for disarmament, demobilization, and the reintegration or political integration where appropriate, ensuring combatants have viable alternatives to violence. Fifthly, ending the external support to armed groups is paramount. Sustained international pressure alongside strict accountability for illicit mineral trade is crucial to dismantle the financial and logistical lifelines of these factors, choking off the oxygen that fuels these conflicts. Finally, strengthened regional cooperation and trust building are vital, like we've stated many times. These regional bodies must facilitate genuine dialogue and enforce agreements, while sustained international humanitarian support remains indispensable for millions affected by the ongoing crisis. So without addressing these interconnected political, economic, and security dimensions, the unwavering commitment and collective responsibility, the tragic cycle of conflict in DRC risks perpetuating indefinitely, demanding a stronger, more coordinated global response.
Well, thank you very much, Lily. I would say that with this, we can end today's episode. And thank you very much again for joining me today. This has been an incredibly insightful discussion about such a complex topic that unfortunately is often absent from the news, despite its great importance. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Lily's article at rayagroup.org and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.